Part 3. Privatizing Politics. Total Combat, 2011 to 2014. There's class warfare, all right, but it's my class, the rich class, that's making war, and we're winning. Warren Buffett. Chapter 11. The Spoils. Plundering Congress. The official opening of the 112th Congress took place on January 5, 2011, when Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, handed off an oversized ceremonial gavel to her successor, John Boehner. But a new era of ultra-conservative billionaire influence had already begun. Before the public swearing-in ceremony got underway, David Koch, whose donor network had spent at least $130.7 million on winning a Republican majority, was in the new Speaker-to-be's ornate office, chatting amiably with his staff. The People's House was under new management and, critics would suggest, new ownership. While Koch was a very public presence in the Capitol, his political adjutant, Tim Phillips, the president of Americans for Prosperity, was deep in the inner sanctum of the congressional committee that mattered most to the bottom line of Koch Industries. Phillips's most important destination that day was the House Energy and Commerce Committee, which under the new Republican majority had now increased its power to block President Obama's environmental agenda in Congress. The committee could bury progress on climate change and harass the Environmental Protection Agency for the foreseeable future. David Koch's public appearance that day signified a remarkable transformation. The Kochs had come far from their days as libertarian losers. As the Los Angeles Times noted a month later, Charles and David Koch no longer sit outside Washington's political establishment, isolated by uncompromising conservatism. Instead, their uncompromising conservatism now dominated one of Congress's two legislative chambers, as well as one of the country's two major political parties. As the paper's headline put it, Koch brothers now at heart of GOP power. That afternoon, after Boehner was sworn in, Koch donned a herringbone tweed overcoat and a camel-colored cashmere muffler and strode out across the Capitol grounds toward Independence Avenue to celebrate. Before he could get far, though, he was stopped by Lee Fang, the dogged liberal blogger for Think Progress who had been chronicling the Koch's rise to power for months. After Fang introduced himself, he and a videographer stuck a microphone in the billionaire's face and asked, "Mr. Koch, are you proud of the Tea Party movement and what they've achieved in the past few years?" "Yeah," Koch said, looking a little befuddled. Phillips, who was at his side, tried to cut the questioning off. "Hey, David, Lee here is a good blogger on the left," he warned his boss with a nervous smile. But Koch, who had impaired hearing in his left ear, either didn't grasp the warning or didn't care, because he kept talking. "There are some extremists there," he acknowledged, "but the rank and file are just normal people like us, and I admire them. It's probably the best grassroots uprising since 1776, in my opinion." Phillips, by this point, was trying to drown out the interview without appearing rude on camera, insistently repeating, "Lee, Lee, I'm very disappointed in you. Lee, you're better than this. Lee, Lee, the interview is over." Fang soldiered on nonetheless, asking Koch what he wanted from the new Congress under Speaker Boehner. "Well," Koch answered with growing animation, licking his lips as he habitually did, "cut the hell out of spending, balance the budget, reduce regulations, and, support business." Later, in a round of image-repairing interviews, the Kochs would portray themselves as disinterested do-gooders and misunderstood social liberals who championed bipartisan issues such as criminal justice reform. But when put on the spot and stripped of public relations help, David Koch made his priorities clear. He regarded his self-interest and the public interest as synonymous. In Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super-Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else, The journalist Chrystia Freeland describes how those with massive financial resources almost universally use them to secure policies beneficial to their interests, often at the expense of the less well-off. In the United States, a number of studies have shown that in recent years, this tendency has distorted politics in very specific ways. In a study he conducted for the nonpartisan Sunlight Foundation, the political scientist Lee Drutman found that increasingly concentrated wealth in America resulted in more polarization and extremism, especially on the right. Very rich benefactors in the Republican Party were far more opposed to taxes and regulations than the rest of the country. The more Republicans depend upon 1% of the 1% donors, the more conservative they tend to be, he discovered. The 112th Congress soon unfolded as a case study of what David Frum, an advisor to the former President George W. Bush, described as the growing, and in his view, destructive influence of the Republican Party's radical rich. The radicalization of the party's donor base, he observed, propelled the party to advocate policies that were more extreme than anything seen since Barry Goldwater's 1964 presidential campaign. It also led Republicans in Congress to try tactics they would never have dared use before. Hard data supported this. Harvard's Theda Scotch poll found that the House took the biggest leap to the far right since political scientists began recording quantitative measurements of legislators' positions. There was no better example than the Koch's newly won influence over the House Energy and Commerce Committee. In the previous Congress, the panel had been chaired by Henry Waxman, the liberal Democrat from California who had quarterbacked the House's successful passage of the cap-and-trade bill, only to see it die in the Senate. Now, the new Republican leadership stocked the committee with oil industry advocates, many of whom owed huge campaign debts to the Kochs. Koch Industries PAC was the single largest oil and gas industry donor to members of the panel, outspending even ExxonMobil. It had donated to 22 of the committee's 31 Republican members and 5 of its Democratic members, too. In addition, 5 out of the 6 Republican freshmen on the committee had received outside support from Americans for Prosperity. Meanwhile, many of the new committee members had signed an unusual pledge swearing fealty to the Koch's agenda. They promised to vote against any kind of carbon tax unless it was offset by comparable spending cuts, an unlikely scenario. The No Climate Tax pledge was invented by Americans for Prosperity in 2008, when the Supreme Court cleared the way for the EPA to regulate greenhouse gases, as it did other pollutants. The Koch's pledge was modeled on the enormously successful one that the anti-tax crusader Grover Norquist had used to intimidate Republican lawmakers from raising taxes, but in this instance, it served not a cause so much as a company. By the start of the legislative session in 2011, fully 156 members of Congress had signed the Koch's No Climate Tax pledge. Many returning members of the House Energy and Commerce Committee had already taken the pledge, and of the 12 new Republicans on the panel, 9 were signatories, including 5 of the 6 freshmen. A prime example of the symbiotic relationship between the Kochs and the committee was Morgan Griffith, who had defeated Rick Boucher in the district that represented Saltville, Virginia, and was among the wave of new appointees to the Energy and Commerce Committee who were openly indebted to the Kochs for their seats. Americans for Prosperity's operatives were guests of honor at a victory rally soon after the election, at which Griffith gushed, "I'm just thankful that you all helped me in so many ways." The Kochs' investment soon paid off. Once in office, Griffith became an outspoken skeptic of mainstream climate science, drawing national ridicule for lecturing scientific experts, as they testified in Congress, that they needed to consider the possibility that Mesopotamia and the Vikings owed their success to global warming, and that melting ice caps on Mars showed that humans were not its cause on Earth. Congressman Griffith also became a lead player in the House Republicans' War on the EPA, demanding that the agency be reined in. Within a month after he took office, he and other House Republicans gutted the EPA's budget by a punishing 27%. The Senate objected, but eventually agreed to cut 16% from the agency that had halted the flow of mercury into Saltville streams. By then, the 1980 Superfund law that had charged polluters like the Olin Corporation for the cleanup costs had expired, and the $3.8 billion that had accumulated in the fund had run out. Nearly half of America's population lived within 10 miles of a toxic waste site, according to one study, but in towns like Saltville, taxpayers rather than corporations were left to clean up the mess. Koch Industries could breathe a bit freer, but the same couldn't be said of those living near its plants. On just one short street, South Penn Road in the blue-collar town of Crossett, Arkansas, 11 of the 15 households had been stricken with cancer. Many residents were convinced their plight was caused by chemical waste dumped by the nearby Georgia-Pacific paper mill, owned by Koch Industries. The air stank so badly that young and old residents stayed indoors, breathing from respirators. The company denied responsibility and pointed out that the cancer claims had earlier been rejected in a class action suit. But David Bowie, a black minister who lived on the street, was trying desperately to get the EPA involved. "All along our street here, we have case after case of cancer," he told the liberal investigative filmmaker Robert Greenwald. "We have a problem in this community for this many people to be sick or dead. Why is the cancer rate so high? Does the paper mill have anything to do with it?" 2 years earlier, USA Today had published a devastating investigative report based on EPA air pollution data that pinpointed a school in Crossett as among the most toxic 1% in the country and identified the Georgia-Pacific plant as a major cause. Lisa Jackson, the EPA's administrator, vowed action, but the congressional budget cuts were huge constraints on doing anything. The numbers regarding Koch Industries' pollution were incontrovertible. In 2012, according to the EPA's Toxic Release Inventory database, which documents the toxic and carcinogenic output of 8,000 American companies, Koch Industries was the number one producer of toxic waste in the United States. It generated 950 million pounds of hazardous materials that year. Of this total output, it released 56.8 million pounds into the air, water, and soil, making it the country's fifth largest polluter. The company was also among the largest emitters of greenhouse gases in America, spewing over 24 million tons of carbon dioxide a year into the atmosphere by 2011, according to the EPA, as much as is typically emitted by 5 million cars. Company officials didn't dispute the statistics, but argued that they merely reflected the size of its operations and the kinds of products it made. They stressed that they had achieved a record of compliance that compared favorably with other manufacturers of their ilk. As Steve Tatum, president of Koch Minerals, put it, "The investment banks, they don't pollute very much because they don't make anything. We make stuff." Another defender on the committee was Mike Pompeo, a freshman Republican from Koch Industries' hometown of Wichita, Kansas, who was so closely entwined with the billionaire brothers that he became known as the Congressman from Koch. The Kochs had once invested an undisclosed amount of money in an aerospace company that Pompeo founded. By the time he ran for office, the Kochs were no longer investors in his business, but had become major backers of his candidacy. Their corporate PAC and Americans for Prosperity also weighed in on his behalf. After his election, Pompeo turned to the company for his chief of staff, choosing Mark Chenoweth, a lawyer who had worked for Koch Industries' lobbying team. Within weeks, Pompeo was championing two of Koch Industries' legislative priorities: opposition to Obama's plans to create a public EPA registry of greenhouse gas polluters and a digital database of consumer complaints about unsafe products. Without publicly accessible data, of course, it would be extremely difficult to track any company's toxic output. Ultimately, the Kochs lost the battle, and the database was created. Koch Industries' lobbying disclosures showed that the company spent over $8 million lobbying Congress in 2011, much of it on environmental issues. The best measure of its new congressional clout might have been the naked belly crawl, as the political reporter Robert Draper termed it, performed by the Michigan Congressman Fred Upton in hopes of snaring the Energy and Commerce Committee's chairmanship. Prior to 2010, Upton had been known as an environmental moderate. In fact, in 2009, before the Tea Partiers and their patrons took charge, he had said, "Climate change is a serious problem that necessitates serious solutions," adding, "I strongly believe that everything must be on the table as we seek to reduce carbon emissions." In 2010, however, Upton, like many Republican moderates, faced a potentially career-killing primary challenge from the right. Upton survived, but others who accepted the growing scientific consensus on climate change, such as Robert Inglis of South Carolina, were defeated, serving as cautionary warnings to the rest. Inglis became convinced of the reality of global warming on a congressional trip to Antarctica, during which scientists showed him polar ice samples containing rising amounts of carbon dioxide following the Industrial Revolution. He was a Christian conservative, but he couldn't in good conscience deny the reality. In the deep red state of South Carolina, his scientific awakening proved his political downfall. "It hurts to be tossed out," he conceded afterward, "but I violated the Republican orthodoxy." In contrast, Upton became a born-again doubter. By 2010, he had renounced his previous climate apostasy and co-authored an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal with Tim Phillips, the president of Americans for Prosperity, in which they called the EPA's plans to regulate carbon emissions an unconstitutional power grab that will kill millions of jobs unless Congress steps in. Upton also joined lawsuits ginned up by Americans for Prosperity aimed at stopping the EPA. The belly crawl paid off. As the new session of Congress began, Upton secured the chairmanship, promising to drag the EPA administrator, Lisa Jackson, to testify before his committee so often he bragged that she would need her own congressional parking space. Soon after, Republicans in the House were proposing measures that Representative Norm Dix, a Democrat from Washington, called a wish list for polluters. In addition to halting action on global warming, they tried to prevent the protection of any new endangered species, permit uranium mining adjacent to the Grand Canyon, deregulate mountaintop mining, and prevent coal ash from being designated a form of air pollution. In an effort to subvert the EPA's core mission, they also proposed legislation requiring it to consider the costs of its regulations, without regard to the scientific and health benefits, which the editorial page of the Los Angeles Times said rips the heart out of the 40-year-old Clean Air Act. 2 months into their tenure, Republicans on the House Energy and Commerce Committee also led a crusade against alternative, renewable energy programs. They successfully branded the government stimulus support for Solyndra, a California manufacturer of solar panels, and other clean energy firms an Obama scandal. In fact, the loan guarantee program in the Energy Department that extended the controversial financing to the company began under the Bush administration. Contrary to the partisan hype, it actually returned a profit to taxpayers. Moreover, while Solyndra's investors were portrayed as Obama supporters, among its biggest backers were members of the conservative Walton family, the founders of Walmart. A huge investor in another solar company that went bust after taking the same Energy Department loans was the venture capitalist Dixon Dahl, a major contributor to the Koch's donor network. But as the House held hearings and various conservative front groups whipped up outrage about crony capitalism, the facts were buried in favor of a narrative that helped the fossil fuel industry. Congressman Upton insisted that he hadn't changed his position on environmental issues, but Jeremy Simmons, then a senior vice president of the nonpartisan National Wildlife Federation, said that the transformation was like night and day. He continued, In the past, the committee majority viewed the Clean Air Act as an effective way to protect the public. Now the committee treats the Clean Air Act and the EPA as if they are the enemy. Voters didn't ask for this pro-polluter agenda, but the Koch brothers spent their money well, and their presence can be felt. At the end of 2011, only 20 of the 65 Republican members of Congress who responded to a survey were willing to say that they believed climate change was causing the planet to warm. Tim Phillips gladly took credit for the dramatic spike and expressed skepticism. If you look at where the situation was 3 years ago and where it is today, there's been a dramatic turnaround, he told the National Journal. Most of these candidates have figured out that the science has become political, he said. We've made great headway. What it means for candidates on the Republican side is, if you buy into green energy or you play footsie on this issue, you do so at your political peril. The vast majority of people who are involved in the Republican nominating process, the conventions and the primaries, are suspect of the science, and that's our influence. Groups like Americans for Prosperity have done it. Fred Koch, the family patriarch, had a saying, according to a former associate, which was that the whale that spouts is the one that gets harpooned. As he had warned, the downside to the brothers' increasing visibility was growing public scrutiny. As the donors gathered for their January summit outside Palm Springs at the beginning of 2011, protesters swarmed the hitherto secret meeting for the first time. Greenpeace, the theatrical environmental group, flew its 135-foot-long airship over the resort. Its day-glow green blimp was emblazoned with huge blow-ups of Charles and David's faces, along with the words, Koch Brothers, Dirty Money. The Koch network was no longer a secret. A squadron of local police in riot gear cordoned off the long, winding driveway to the Rancho Mirage Resort, which was in virtual lockdown, while a ragtag assortment of protesters out front waved signs proclaiming, Koch kills and uncloak the Kochs. Some 25 arrests were made, and the Kochs' private security guards, wearing gold-colored K's in their lapels, threatened to add one more when they caught the Politico reporter Kenneth Vogel in the resort's cafe. Unless he left the premises immediately, they warned, they would make a citizen's arrest, forcing him to spend a night in the Riverside County Jail. Inside the fortified resort, some of America's most celebrated corporate chieftains huddled with Charles Koch, including the DeVos family of Amway, Ken Langone of Home Depot, and Tully Friedman, the private equity tycoon who was also chairman of the American Enterprise Institute. Like besieged royalty, David Koch and his wife Julia, in dark sunglasses, made a brief appearance from one of the hotel's balconies, from which they grimly surveyed the street theater below. The heavy-handed security reflected a more combative stance on the part of the Kochs toward the backlash that their outsized role in the public arena was stirring. Confidants described the brothers as obsessed with leaks and stung by the critical press coverage. They seemed surprised and resentful that their growing political influence had resulted in heightened scrutiny. They were accustomed to thinking of themselves as private citizens, and public-spirited ones at that. A golf partner said David spumed and sputtered about the New Yorker and other publications that had scrutinized the brothers, blaming the media for spurring death threats and forcing his family to hire personal bodyguards. The Kochs also spoke darkly and inaccurately about the Obama White House conspiring with reporters to smear them. They somehow thought that they could run tens of millions of dollars in ads but fly under the radar screen, and that nobody was going to find out, a conservative source familiar with the Kochs told Politico. So they're scrambling now because they weren't nearly as prepared as they should have been. To handle the growing number of critics, particularly in the press, they brought in a new team of public relations advisors specializing in aggressive tactics. Michael Goldfarb, for instance, a Republican political operative whom the company hired at this point to improve its image, was described by the New York Times as a conservative provocateur who used a blowtorch as his pen. Goldfarb had worked for Sarah Palin's vice presidential campaign, where he described his job as attack the press. Later, he founded an online publication called The Washington Free Beacon that practiced what its editor called combat journalism against liberal gas bags. Its motto was, do unto them. In a profile, one conservative journalist told the New Republic, I mean no disrespect, and I like him personally, but he is the single shadiest person on the right. Joining Goldfarb was Philip Ellender, co-president of Coke Company's public sector, who oversaw the company's lobbying and public relations operations in Washington, and who had a reputation, as Politico described it, for using tactics that have helped cement the view that the Kochs play rough. Ellender oversaw a crisis communication project that included frequent polling to assess damage to the company's public image. To fight back, he launched a pugnacious corporate website called Coke Facts that waged ad hominem attacks, questioning the professionalism and integrity of reporters whose work the company found unflattering, ranging from the New York Times to Politico. Brass-knuckle tactics were nothing new for the Koch brothers, but they were now deploying them against legitimate news reporters. I got a taste of these tactics on the afternoon of January 3, 2011, when an email popped onto my screen from David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, where I had been a staff writer since 1994. Remnick is a brilliant and busy editor who doesn't bother his writers unnecessarily. When he gets in touch, there's usually a good reason. In his email, Remnick explained that 10 minutes earlier he'd received a baffling inquiry about me from Keith Kelly, the reporter who covered the media industry for the New York Post. Unsure how to respond, Remnick forwarded it and asked, "Can you help me out on this stuff?" He added courteously, "Sorry to bother you with this." "Hi," Kelly's inquiry began breezily. "We're hearing that a right-wing blogger may be preparing to let fly some pretty serious claims against Jane Mayer. On the one hand, it may be seen as payback for her bring-down of the Koch brothers in August 2010. His reference was to a 10,000-word article I had written for The New Yorker 5 months earlier, titled Covert Operations, with the reading line, "The Billionaire Brothers Who Are Waging a War Against Obama." The story revealed in depth, for the first time, how the publicity-shy Koch brothers had stealthily leveraged their vast fortune to exert outsized influence over American politics. It also showed that their environmental and safety record was woefully at odds with their burnished public images as selfless philanthropists. I had previously devoted the same amount of space in The New Yorker to profiling another such plutocratic donor, George Soros, a billionaire investor who spent a fortune underwriting liberal organizations and candidates. Soros hadn't liked the story, but he accepted that tough questions were to be expected from the press in a democracy. In contrast, when The New Yorker story on the Kochs came out, the brothers were enraged. Their company's general counsel, Mark Holden, later described the story as a wake-up call, admitting, "We didn't have a response that was ready to go." Spearheading an aggressive damage control effort, he soon sent a letter of complaint to the magazine. He was unable to identify any factual errors, but argued that contrary to the article's title, Covert Operations, there was nothing secretive or covert about them. Yet the Kochs, unlike Soros, had declined to grant The New Yorker an interview. Instead, after our story ran, David Koch denounced it in the Daily Beast as hateful, ludicrous, and plain wrong. But his complaints lacked specificity, requiring no corrections, and so the magazine stood by the story and we moved on. The calm, however, was deceptive. In a squat Washington office building 3 blocks from the White House, a boiler room operation formed. Beginning in the summer of 2010, as the Kochs were ramping up spending on the midterm elections, half a dozen or so highly paid operatives labored secretly in borrowed office space in the back of the lobbying firm run by the former Congressman J.C. Watts. Their aim, according to a well-informed source, was to counteract the New Yorker story on the Koch brothers by undermining me. Dirt, dirt, dirt is what the source later told me they were digging for in my life. If they couldn't find it, they'd create it. Reprising the intimidating tactics that critics of Koch Industries had complained of for years, a private investigative firm with powerful political and law enforcement connections was retained. The firm, it appears, was Vigilant Resources International, whose founder and chairman, Howard Safier, had been New York City's police commissioner under the former mayor, Rudolph Giuliani. The firm advertised itself as upholding the highest standards of confidentiality and discretion. It's uncommon for a private detective to be hired to conduct a retaliatory investigation into a reporter's character. It is, after all, the job of the press to cover politics. How much, if at all, the Kochs were personally involved in these activities remains unclear. Often, private investigators are hired indirectly, working for law firms retained by the principals so that they can claim attorney-client privilege, preserve deniability, and erase fingerprints. Asked whether he had investigated me, Howard Safier said only, "I don't comment. I don't confirm or deny it." His son, Adam Safier, who worked with him in the firm, also declined to comment. An effort to interview Charles and David Koch resulted in an email from their company's spokesman, Steve Lombardo, saying simply, "We will have to decline." Asked in a follow-up email whether the company had mounted a private investigation into me, he declined to respond. However, clues leading back to the Kochs were everywhere. Sources described Goldfarb, Ellender, and other Koch Industries personnel as deeply involved in the project. Leading it, one source said, was Nancy Fotenhauer, a longtime member of the Koch's inner circle who has served as a Koch Industries spokesperson, as the head of its Washington office, and as the president of Americans for Prosperity. I had no inkling about this until that fall, when a few months after my story ran, a blogger called me to ask if I had heard the rumor that I was the target of some sort of cloak-and-dagger private detective's investigation. I laughed it off. At a Christmas party that winter, I was equally nonchalant when a former reporter pulled me aside with an odd warning. "This may be nothing," she said, but a private investigator she knew had mentioned there were a couple of conservative billionaires who wanted help digging up dirt on a Washington reporter. The reporter had written a story they disliked. It occurred to me afterward that the reporter they wanted to investigate might be you. These warnings flashed through my mind as I read the email that Remnick forwarded from the New York Post reporter that afternoon in January. Kelly, the Post reporter, was hoping to get comment on allegations that he said were about to be published against me, claiming that I had borrowed heavily from other reporters' work. Before I had the chance to respond, though, a second set of emails reached both Remnick and me. This time, the sender was Jonathan Strong, then a reporter at the online conservative news site The Daily Caller, whose editor, Tucker Carlson, was a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Strong, too, it appeared, was about to publish a hit piece on me. His emails were ominous, asking Remnick outright whether my work fell within the realm of plagiarism. He provided several samples of my writing and demanded an answer by 10 o'clock the next morning. Plagiarism ranks pretty high up on the list of crimes of moral turpitude in journalism. In a business where your name and credibility are everything, allegations like these could prove ruinous. Upon close inspection, though, it became clear that the allegations were inane and easily refutable. Someone, probably using a computer program, had mechanically sifted through almost a decade of my work and isolated quotations from officials and other widely repeated phrases to argue that the structure and wording were quite close to four other reporters' news stories. None of the supposedly purloined sentences were of any particular significance. This wasn't the sort of material anyone who actually knew anything about journalism would pay any attention to. Even sillier, In two of the four stories I was alleged to have plagiarized, I had specifically given credit to the authors whose work the Daily Caller was claiming I'd stolen. In 25 years of journalism, I'd made my share of spectacular mistakes, but no one had ever accused me of misappropriating their work. In fact, I'd always gone out of my way to credit others. But I also knew that if these charges weren't answered immediately, the truth would scarcely matter. Once the smear got into print, people would assume that there must have been something to it. I was later told that by cooking up these charges, the boiler room operatives felt close to victory. "They thought they had you. They thought they were going to be knighted by the Kochs," said one source. Their search for dirt had started with my personal life, I was told, but when that turned up nothing truly incriminating, they moved on to plagiarism. With only a few hours before these allegations were set to go online, all I could do was to try to get out the truth before the lies were spread. By midnight, I had reached three of the four authors from whom I was alleged to have plagiarized. All offered to make public statements supporting me and denying I had misappropriated their work. The Daily Caller's reporter hadn't even interviewed them. Li Fang, a blogger for the liberal website Think Progress, whose pathbreaking work on the Kochs I had cited in my story, issued a statement saying, "These accusations are without merit." He went on, "Ms. Mayer properly credited me in her story and clearly did a ton of her own research. I have nothing but admiration for her integrity as a journalist." Paul Kane, a reporter at The Washington Post, quickly looked up the story in question and sent me an email saying, "Not only did you not steal from me, you fricking credited me in the very next line." The New Yorker had even linked to his story online. And, I later learned, my husband, who was then an editor at The Washington Post, had edited the story that I supposedly stole. The allegations were becoming comical. The third reporter I reached also gave a statement saying she had no complaints. Later, the fourth did as well. If this was the best opposition research money could buy, it was pretty shoddy. I sent the facts to the Daily Caller, which, after confirming them, dropped the story. But Keith Kelly, to his credit, kept reporting. He tried to press the Koch spokesman on whether they were behind the smear, but, interestingly, got no response. He wrote a follow-up called "Smear Disappears," asking, "Who is behind the apparently concerted campaign to smear the New Yorker's Jane Mayer?" He noted, "The story is dead, but the person or persons behind the allegations remains a shadowy mystery." He asked the Daily Caller's editor, Carlson, who its source was, but Carlson claimed, "I have no clue where we got it." There actually was a big clue. The plagiarism ploy had been timed to try to stop the New Yorker from nominating the Koch story for a national magazine award, according to the New York Post, and when the New Yorker went ahead and nominated the story anyway, the Kochs tried to stand in the way. Koch Industries' general counsel, Holden, sent a highly unusual letter to the board of the American Society of Magazine Editors trying to stop it from picking my story for the prize. The story didn't win anyway. Que sera. By then, as David Remnick told the New York Post, the whole opposition research campaign seemed pathetic. He added derisively, "I'm a little surprised to see a big-time operation behave like a bunch of Inspector Clouseaus." The Kochs also went after Ed Crane, the Cato Institute head, who admitted to having been behind an unattributed quotation in my New Yorker story making light of Charles's market-based management system. In response, shortly before the January 2011 summit, Charles invoked his ownership of Cato shares to force a management change, insisting that two longtime company loyalists, Nancy Fotenhauer and Kevin Gentry, neither of whom was known as a deep libertarian thinker, join the think tank's board. Crane, who had co-founded Cato, was furious. But it was prelude to the final shakeup later that year, in which Charles and David forced him out completely. David reportedly told Cato's chairman of the board, Robert Levy, that instead of producing esoteric intellectual theories, the ostensibly nonpartisan think tank should provide intellectual ammunition that we can then use at Americans for Prosperity and our allied organizations to influence elections. If anything, the Koch's ham-fisted reaction to criticism and sense of aggrieved embattlement seem to have only spurred their backers on, because by the time they left the guarded enclave near Palm Springs on February 1, 2011, the Koch coffers had $49 million more to spend. The bidding during the final fundraising spree was so exuberant that one hotel staffer claimed he heard donors making pledges in increments of $5 million. With the House of Representatives safely delivered, the group was now on a roll, looking ahead to finishing off Obama once and for all in 2012. First, though, there was a lot of discussion about how they could help the Republicans in the House now that the GOP had the majority. Sean Noble, who continued as a contract political consultant to the Kochs, was pushing hard for them to start by helping Paul Ryan, the Wisconsin congressman who was the incoming chairman of the House Budget Committee. For the big donors, Ryan was a superstar, a square-jawed, blue-eyed, earnest young Ayn Rand disciple described as wonky so often it seemed affixed to his title. His problem, though, was that his budget-slashing ideas scared the public, horrified liberals, and worried many Republicans, too. As he put it himself, "There's a lot of sharp knives in my drawer." In the coming congressional session, Ryan planned to introduce a budget proposal that would serve as a blueprint for hard-line fiscal conservatives. No one expected it to pass in 2011 because the Democrats still held the Senate and the White House. But if Ryan gathered enough support, he could push the party hard to the right, tie Obama in knots, and provide a first draft for the GOP's 2012 platform. Tactically, a lot was riding on his success. For several years, Ryan had been advocating radically deep cuts in government spending, including to Medicare and Medicaid, the two main government health programs for the elderly and the poor. He had also floated the idea of partially privatizing Social Security by introducing alternative private retirement accounts. He argued that the bloodletting was necessary for the country's fiscal health. The deficit, in his view, was reaching a crisis level, and these programs were unsustainable. His ideas were wildly popular with most of the wealthy donors. As the country's highest taxpayers, they would be the biggest beneficiaries of the tax savings produced by spending cuts. Moreover, none of them needed to rely on government social services for their health or welfare. But many of Ryan's ideas were anathema to much of the middle class. When President George W. Bush had tried to privatize Social Security, a plan pushed by the Cato Institute, he had been forced to retreat in the face of overwhelming public opposition. The reality was that despite mobilizing the Tea Party, the big conservative donors had a number of different priorities from the less affluent followers. Tea Party leaders had deliberately fudged their agenda on Social Security in order not to alienate the followers, according to one study. They talked in vague terms about keeping America from going broke, but avoided specifics. Meanwhile, not one grassroots Tea Party supporter encountered by the study's authors argued for privatizing Social Security. Entitlement programs aiding the middle class were in fact so popular with most Americans that they were virtually sacrosanct. While rich, free market enthusiasts often favored replacing these programs with market-oriented alternatives, polls showed that virtually everyone else was adamantly opposed to the kinds of changes that Newt Gingrich candidly called right-wing social engineering. To popularize his radical budget plan, Ryan would need help. And Noble soon came up with a way for the donors to deliver it. He suggested they pay for expensive private polling and market testing to help Ryan fine-tune his pitch, as well as a campaign by AstroTurf groups to create a drumbeat of public support. It was an intriguing idea, but it teetered on the edge of impropriety. Drafting the government's annual budget was a core congressional function. At first, in the beginning of 2011, the donors were unenthused about the idea. Having already paid for an expensive election, they didn't understand why they now also needed to pay for polling and focus groups about government policy. But in the following months, this changed, and mysterious money from the Koch network started flowing. Much of it moved from the donors to a 501c4 social welfare group cryptically called the TC4 Trust, working closely with a subgroup focused on budget issues called public notice. The TC4 Trust was little more than a UPS box in Alexandria, Virginia, but between 2009 and 2011, it reported revenue to the IRS of approximately $46 million and gave away some $37 million to other conservative nonprofit groups. It defined itself as a free market advocacy group and filed papers with the IRS proclaiming that the grant funds shall not be used for political activity, but it soon was paying for polling and a public advocacy campaign aimed at shaping and selling the Republican budget. Ed Goas, the president of the Terrence Group, a Republican polling company that worked on the budget project, said that the challenge was to minimize political damage from cuts to entitlement spending. It wasn't about developing policy, Goas said. It was about selling it. The solution, it appears, was to avoid the frank use of the word cut when talking about Medicare or Social Security. There was discussion that you could deal with it as getting your money's worth out of the government, said Goas. You could talk about it as more effective, but not as cutting it. It had to be more about efficiencies. That was a large part of it, he said. Public Notice, which paid for the research, also mounted a public advocacy campaign describing the deficit as a looming catastrophe. Public Notice was one of the Koch brothers groups, Goas confirmed, adding that his firm worked for it for 3 or 4 years while simultaneously advising Ryan. Ryan evidently proved eminently teachable. He was expert in the fine print of the budget, but less certain about the public relations. So long as what emerged from these sessions was in line with his values, he was described as grateful for the help. Moreover, unlike most such advice, it came prepaid. As President Obama worked up his own budget proposal that spring, a process at the heart of governing, he had no idea that some of the richest people in the country, with huge stakes in the outcome, were partly paying to shape and sell the Republican alternative. As the attention lavished on Ryan suggested, tax issues loomed large on the victorious donors' agenda. Dull though the mechanics can be, as Neera Tanden, the president of the Liberal Center for American Progress, puts it, when oligarchs control the levers of government, they get the spoils. It's litigated through tax policy. Even before the Republicans formally took control of the House, the president felt forced into making concessions on tax issues vital to the donor class. In December 2010, he reached a deal that temporarily extended unemployment benefits to the millions of Americans still out of work, along with reducing payroll taxes and providing other help for the middle class. In exchange, Obama gave Republicans what they most wanted— an extension of the Bush-era income tax cuts that had disproportionately benefited the wealthy, which were slated to automatically expire. Those cuts had lowered the top income tax rate from 39.6% to 35%. With bipartisan support, Bush had also slashed taxes on unearned income, most of which went to the rich. Taxes on dividends, for instance, were reduced dramatically from 39.6% to 15%. Taxes on capital gains, the overwhelming bulk of which were reaped by the wealthy, fell from 20% to 15%. As a result, many of the richest Americans were taxed at lower rates than middle and working class wage earners. A 2008 study of the wealthiest 400 taxpayers, for instance, showed that they earned an average of $202 million. And paid an effective income tax rate of less than 20%. Fully 60% of their declared income derived from capital gains. In other words, the effective tax rate on earning $202 million was lower than the rate paid by Americans earning $34,501 a year. The tax code hadn't always been so lopsided. As income grew increasingly concentrated at the top during the 20th century, the tax code grew more generous to those with extreme wealth in response to the political pressure they put on lawmakers. The first peacetime income tax was enacted in 1894 as the result of William Jennings Bryan's populist movement and applied to only the richest 85,000 Americans out of a population of 65 million, or the top 0.1%. But the Supreme Court struck it down after the robber barons waged a proxy legal battle. 18 years later, the 16th Amendment to the Constitution legalized the income tax, which in the beginning was only levied on the very rich. Rates were especially high in war times, when the taxes were seen as part of the patriotic duty of the privileged. During World War I, top earners paid a rate of 77%, and during World War II, they paid a rate of 94%. It was this tax that the Scaife family had avoided with its elaborate trusts and foundations. Soon, though, those at the very top succeeded in shifting the burden to those beneath them, so that by 1942, nearly two-thirds of the population paid income taxes. The rates remained relatively progressive for decades, with the top bracket paying a 50% rate in 1981. But the 1970s kicked off a three-decade-long tax-cutting spree, during which the wealthiest 1% succeeded in getting their average effective federal tax rate slashed by a third, and the very, very richest, the 0.01% of the population, did even better, getting its effective federal tax rate cut in half. Unsurprisingly, the distribution of wealth in America grew increasingly skewed. Critics argued that the extraordinarily rich had managed to shirk their fair share, but this was not how Charles Koch looked at it. He argued that there is no fair share of the tax burden. The notion that cutting taxes on the wealthy shifted the burden to others, he said, was a false premise. Everyone's taxes should be cut, he argued. The aim, he said, was to shrink the government. Our goal, he wrote in an impassioned essay in 1978, is not to reallocate the burden of government. Our goal is to roll back government. From the standpoint of a radically anti-government libertarian, paying lower taxes wasn't a matter of greed, it was a matter of principle. Libertarianism elevated tax avoidance into a principled crusade. Indeed, Koch argued that it was a moral act for the wealthy to cut their own taxes. As he put it in the same essay, morally, lowering taxes is simply defending property rights. It was, as the Libertarian Party platform put it in 1980, the responsibility of citizens to challenge the cult of the omnipotent state. Foster Freeze, the Wyoming mutual fund manager who had joined political forces with the Kochs since the 1980s, depicted opposition to taxes as selfless too, but from a slightly different angle. He argued that the public benefited more when the wealthy paid less because the rich could do more good with their money than the government. Wealthy people self-tax, he argued, by contributing to charities. It's a question. Do you believe the government should be taking your money and spending it for you, or do you want to spend it for you? He argued, it's that top 1% that probably contributes more to making the world a better place than the 99%. Charles Koch, however, favored neither taxes nor charity. As he explained in a speech in 1999, I agree with the 12th century philosopher Maimonides, who defined the highest form of charity as dispensing with charity altogether by enabling your fellow humans to have the wherewithal to earn their own living. But according to the cultural critic and Jewish scholar Leon Wieseltier, who has taught several university courses on Maimonides, this is false and tendentious and idiotic. He explains, Maimonides did indeed prize the sort of charity that made its recipient more self-reliant, but he believed that the duty of charity is permanent, and that the responsibility to help the poor was unequivocal and absolute. In fact, he points out, Maimonides declared that he who averts his eyes from the obligation of charity is regarded as a villain. While Koch and others in his group described their opposition to taxes as matters of pure principle, they put the Obama administration under constant pressure to accept tax cuts that directly increased their own wealth at the expense of everyone else. To reach the deal in December 2010, for instance, Republican negotiators insisted on cuts in estate taxes that would cost the Treasury $23 billion and save some 6,600 of the wealthiest taxpayers an average of $1.5 million each. The demand didn't materialize out of thin air. For years, some of the Republican Party's wealthiest backers, including the Kochs and the DeVosses, had been agitating to abolish what were cleverly dubbed death taxes. The Kochs joined with 16 of the other richest families in the country, including the Waltons of Walmart and the Mars Candy Clan, in financing and coordinating a massive multi-year campaign to reduce and eventually repeal inheritance taxes. According to one 2006 report, these 17 families stood to save $71 billion from the tax change, explaining why they willingly spent almost half a billion collectively lobbying for it, beginning in 1998. They were represented by a handful of front groups, including the American Family Business Institute, which strove to cast the tax break as necessary to preserve family farms. Unfortunately, in 2001, the group couldn't find a single family farm put out of business by the estate tax. After Hurricane Katrina, the same group scoured the country to find a storm victim whose heirs were hurt by the estate tax in order to create some sympathy for its cause, but again failed to find a single one. In truth, only 0.27% of all estates were wealthy enough to be affected by estate taxes. The lengths that some members of the Kochs' donor circle went to, hoping to ensure the biggest possible share of their family's fortunes, were impressive. The Koch brothers were far from alone in having litigated aggressively against their relatives. One member of their network during this period, Susan Gore, heiress to a piece of the Gore-Tex fabric fortune and founder of a conservative think tank called the Wyoming Liberty Group, was so intent on increasing her personal inheritance that she tried to legally adopt her ex-husband in order to claim that she had as many children as her siblings and thereby enlarge her portion of the family trust. But in late 2011, a judge rejected the 72-year-old heiress's scheme, ruling that she could not count her former husband as her son. Although it enraged progressives, President Obama reluctantly consented to many of the Republicans' demands, including the enlarged exemptions from the estate tax. He had campaigned against extending the Bush tax cuts for those earning over $250,000 a year, but in December 2010, with the Republicans poised to take over the House, he tried to convince his disappointed supporters that this was the best deal they were likely to get for some time. It used to be that you could govern by peeling off a couple of Republicans to do the right thing, he said. But now, Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin are the center of the Republican Party, and there is no possibility of cooperation. December's machinations were just the opening act, it turned out, in an unfolding drama in which Republicans in the House would eventually threaten to default on paying America's debts, potentially pitching the fragile U.S. economy into a calamitous freefall in order to extort further tax and spending concessions favored by wealthy donors. All of this played out against a backdrop of growing economic inequality and stagnating social mobility. The United States, which idealized itself as a classless society in which everyone had the opportunity to get ahead, had, in fact, fallen behind many other rich nations in terms of intergenerational economic mobility, including such old-world class-bound countries as France, Germany, and Spain. Advancing the agenda of America's wealthiest winners under such circumstances would ordinarily be a hard sell. After all, in 2011, 24 million Americans were still out of work. The Great Recession had wiped out some $9 trillion in household wealth. But after 40 years, the conservative nonprofit ecosystem had grown quite adept at waging battles of ideas. The think tanks, advocacy groups, and talking heads on the right sprang into action, shaping a political narrative that staved off the kind of course correction that might otherwise have been expected. A key skirmish in this battle was the reframing of the history of the 2008 economic crash. From an empirical standpoint, it was hard to see it as anything other than a wipeout for the proponents of free market fundamentalism and an argument for stronger government regulations. Like the Great Depression, it might have been expected to produce a backlash against those seen as irresponsible profiteers, resulting in more government intervention and a fairer tax system. Joseph Stiglitz, the liberal economist, described the 2008 financial meltdown as the equivalent for free market advocates to the fall of the Berlin Wall for communists. Even the former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, Washington's free market wise man nonpareil, admitted that he'd been wrong in thinking Adam Smith's invisible hand would save business from its own self-destruction. Potentially, the disaster was a teachable moment from which the country's economic conservatives could learn. This is not what happened, however. They instead started with their preferred conclusion and worked backward to reach it. In what the economic writer and asset manager Barry Ritholtz labeled Wall Street's big lie, scholars at conservative think tanks argued that the problem had been too much government, not too little. The lead role in the revisionism was played by the American Enterprise Institute, whose board was stocked with financial industry titans, many of whom were free market zealots and regulars at the Koch donor seminars. Specifically, AEI argued that government programs that helped low-income home buyers get mortgages caused the collapse. Ritholtz noted that these theories failed to withstand even casual scrutiny. There was plenty wrong with the government's quasi-private mortgage lenders Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, but numerous nonpartisan studies, ranging from Harvard University's Joint Center for Housing Studies to the Government Accountability Office, proved they were not a major cause of the 2008 crash. Yet by shifting the blame, Ritholtz noted, those whose bad judgment and failed philosophy helped cause the crisis could continue to champion the false narrative that free markets require no adult supervision. Self-serving research from corporate-backed conservative think tanks wasn't exactly news by 2011, but what was surprising, Ritholtz contended, was that they are winning, thanks to the endless repetition of the big lie. Phil Angelides, the chairman of the bipartisan commission that Congress set up to investigate the causes of the crash, was also taken aback by the revisionism. In an op-ed column, he tried to remind the public that it had been the recklessness of the financial industry and the abject failures of policymakers and regulators that brought the economy to its knees. Instead, though, he said, those at the top of the economic heap were peddling shop-worn data that had been analyzed and debunked by the committee. He conceded that history was written by the winners, and that by 2011, while much of the country lagged behind, most of the financial sector had bounced back, and the historical rewrite is in full swing. Soon, politicians backed by the same conservative donors who funded the think tanks were echoing the big lie. Marco Rubio, a rising Republican star from Florida, for instance, who had defeated a moderate in the 2010 Republican Senate primary with the help of 49 donors from the June 2010 Koch seminar, soon proclaimed, "This idea that our problems were caused by a government that was too small, it's just not true. In fact, a major cause of our recent downturn was a housing crisis created by reckless government policies." Against this backdrop, on April 15, 2011, Ryan's budget plan, now packaged as the Path to Prosperity, came up for a vote in the House of Representatives. In the past, its prospects had been uncertain at best. Not just Democrats, but many Republicans had deemed previous versions too harsh. A year earlier, Speaker of the House John Boehner had given it only lukewarm support. But by then, the Republican caucus had moved far to the right, and the proposal had been repackaged. It now passed easily in the House, 235 to 193, losing only 4 Republican votes, but not attracting a single Democrat. In the name of fixing Medicare, it shrank it to voucher-like premium supports, with which senior citizens could buy private medical insurance. It also transformed Medicaid into a tattered patchwork of state-run block grants while cutting overall funding. Further, it repealed the Medicaid expansion that was a part of Obama's Affordable Care Act. At the same time, it reduced income taxes into 2 rates, cutting the top rate down to 25%, half of what it was when Ronald Reagan was elected. Theoretically, any losses were to be made up by eliminating deductions, but these were not specified. As the New York Times reporter Noam Scheiber summarizes it in The Escape Artists, How Obama's Team Fumbled the Recovery, Ryan's plan cut taxes for the wealthy by $2.4 trillion in comparison with Obama's proposed budget, and then cut spending by $6.2 trillion. He describes it in short as right-wing lunacy. The most shocking aspect was its radical rewrite of America's social contract. To reduce the deficit, Ryan prescribed massive cuts in government spending, 62% of which would come from programs for the poor, even though these programs accounted for only about a fifth of the federal budget. According to a New York Times analysis of a similar, later version of Ryan's budget, 1.8 million people would be cut off food stamps, 280,000 children would lose their school lunch subsidies, and 300,000 children would lose medical coverage. Robert Greenstein of the Liberal Center on Budget and Policy Priorities called the plan Robin Hood in reverse, arguing, "It would likely produce the largest redistribution of income from the bottom to the top in modern U.S. history." The plan was successfully sold, nonetheless, winning a chorus of acclaim from conservative pundits and think tank scholars, whom the Republican leadership had treated to high-level policy briefings. Singing the plan's praise were the Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation, and Grover Norquist's powerful anti-tax group, Americans for Tax Reform, which declared, "Paul Ryan's budget is what a real conservative budget looks like." Many other nonprofit advocacy groups like Public Notice, the 60 Plus Association, the Independent Women's Forum, and American Commitment also chimed in for the drastic spending cuts. The clamor seemed multitudinous, but beneath the surface, each of these groups shared a common aquifer, the pool of cash contributed by the Koch donor network. A number of opinion writers also embraced Ryan as oracular. David Brooks, a moderately conservative New York Times columnist whose opinion Obama valued, declared Ryan's plan the most courageous budget reform proposal any of us have seen in our lifetimes. His proposal will set the standard of seriousness for anybody who wants to play in this discussion. It will become the 2012 Republican platform, no matter who is the nominee. The broader news media also echoed Ryan's claim that the federal deficit was the most pressing economic issue facing the country. As Freeland noted in Plutocrats, in April and May, the 5 largest papers in the country published over 3 times more stories about the deficit than they did about jobs, even though unemployment was at 9%. The right had succeeded in setting the terms of the economic debate, a good outcome for the 1%, she writes. Ryan's success in convincing much of the Washington media establishment that he was tackling hard problems, showing leadership, and bravely putting forth a plan to rescue entitlement programs while also fixing the country's daunting deficit threw the White House into a tailspin. It scrambled to put forth its own new alternative plan, which, to the dismay of liberals, called for additional cuts in spending beyond those the administration had already offered. Top political advisors to the president, like David Plouffe and Bill Daley, had long been preoccupied with looking centrist and winning independent voters, rather than catering to their liberal base, whom Plouffe had memorably dismissed as bedwetters. President Obama now proposed $4 trillion in spending cuts over the next 12 years, not all that far from the $4.4 trillion that Ryan had proposed. The proposal so distressed Hillary Clinton, then Secretary of State, a colleague said she had to go outside and get some air. Then, in what came to be known as the ambush, the White House invited Ryan to Obama's speech unveiling his counterproposal. With the congressman sitting in front of him, Obama lambasted Ryan's plan as a vision that says we can't afford to keep the promises we made to our seniors. Put simply, it ends Medicare as we know it. Obama accused the Republicans of giving more than $1 trillion in new tax breaks to the wealthy and argued that it was less about reducing the deficit than it's about changing the basic social compact in America. Ryan was affronted at being attacked so publicly and personally. The breach of decorum became a mini flap in Washington. Obama later told Bob Woodward that he hadn't known Ryan was there in the auditorium when he delivered his pointed speech. "We made a mistake," he confessed. Out in the country, where people were less concerned with political etiquette than whether their benefits were about to be slashed, Ryan's proposed Medicare makeover proved immediately toxic. A Democratic underdog in a special congressional election in upstate New York clobbered the expected Republican winner by campaigning against Ryan's Medicare plan. But the House Republicans were jubilant anyway. They had forced Obama to play their budget game. Instead of talking about jobs and spending, he was talking about the deficit and bargaining with them over how many trillions to cut. "We led. They reacted to us," exulted Kevin McCarthy, the House Republican whip. The donors were excited, too. Just the fact that Obama had been thrown on the defensive convinced those whose fortunes had helped pay for the Ryan plan that their investment was worth it. By late spring, the House Republicans had Obama in a bind on another issue as well. No sooner had the president reached a temporary budget agreement with the Republicans, one that included large Democratic concessions, than the self-styled Young Guns, backed by the Tea Party faction in the House, forced a fight over raising the debt ceiling, a pro forma measure long used to authorize payment of the country's financial obligations. It looked as if the Tea Party radicals were protesting profligate spending, but in fact all they were doing was refusing to formally authorize payment of funds that Congress had already appropriated. In essence, refusing to pay Congress's credit card bill after the previous year's shopping spree. In the end, their self-destructive fight hurt themselves more than anyone else, but meanwhile, the radicals' willingness to pitch the U.S. government into default created a national crisis. The increasingly desperate standoff might produce chaos and dysfunction, but that prospect merely served the conservatives' anti-government agenda. In the words of Mike Lofgren, a longtime Republican congressional aide, his party was becoming like an apocalyptic cult. If Congress failed to pay its bills, the country's AAA credit rating would be downgraded, potentially rocking markets, shaking business confidence, and worsening the painful recession. No one knew exactly how bad the consequences of default would be. Ordinarily, it would be unthinkable. Boehner had warned the insurgents in his caucus that they needed to deal with it as adults. But Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader and a founder of the Young Guns, seized on the debt ceiling vote as what he called a leverage moment. By 2011, the extremist upstarts had formed a powerful clique within the party's leadership and appeared itching to challenge Boehner's authority. Many owed more to the Kochs and other radical rich backers than they did to the party. The White House was under the misimpression that stolid business forces within the Republican Party would see the threat to the economy and force the radicals back from the edge. But while more traditional business interests, as represented by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, took this stance, the right flank of the donor base was urging the Young Guns on to a showdown. In the Wall Street Journal, Stanley Druckenmiller, a billionaire hedge fund manager, described government default as less catastrophic than if we don't solve the real problem, by which he meant government spending. and Charles Koch made clear in a March 2011 op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal that he regarded any raise of the debt ceiling as simply a way to delay tough decisions. Pushing the young guns forward toward the financial cliff was Americans for Prosperity, the Koch's political arm. Some 40 other Tea Party and anti-tax groups also clamored for all-out war. Among the most vociferous was the Club for Growth, a small, single-minded Wall Street-founded group powerful for one reason. It had the cash to mount primary challenges against Republicans who didn't hew to its uncompromising line. The club had developed the use of fratricide as a tactic to keep office holders in line after becoming frustrated that many candidates it backed became more moderate in office. It discovered that all it had to do was threaten a primary challenge and they start wetting their pants, one founder joked. Its top funders included many in the Koch network, including the billionaire hedge fund managers Robert Mercer and Paul Singer, and the private equity tycoon John Childs. The young guns portrayed their opposition to compromise as a matter of pure principle, but beneath the surface, huge vested interests were at play. The president and Boehner were close to negotiating what they called a grand bargain that anticipated closing some tax loopholes. The young guns were categorically opposed to reforms that might cut into the profits of hedge funds and private equity firms. Cantor was especially protective of the carried interest tax loophole. For him, the happiness of hedge fund and private equity titans was personal. He was among the House's top recipients of contributions from securities and investment firms. Three of the largest contributors to Cantor's two campaign funds in 2010 were financiers affiliated with the Koch network: Stephen Cohen, the billionaire founder of the hugely lucrative hedge fund SAC Capital; Paul Singer, the multimillionaire head of the so-called vulture fund Elliott Management; and Stephen Schwarzman, the billionaire co-founder of the Blackstone Group. So although one study showed that the top 25 hedge fund managers earned an average of nearly $600 million a year, and that closing this one loophole would raise $20 billion over the next decade, Cantor and the other rebels in the House who professed concern over the deficit crisis refused to back Boehner's proposed grand bargain. As tensions built in the increasingly calamitous debt ceiling stalemate, two sources say Boehner traveled to New York to personally beseech David Koch's help. One former advisor to the Koch family says that Boehner begged David to call off the dogs. He pointed out that if the country defaulted, David's own investments would tank. A spokeswoman for Boehner, Emily Schillinger, confirmed the visit, but insisted, "Anyone who knows Speaker Boehner knows he doesn't beg." But the spectacle of the Speaker of the House, who was among the most powerful elected officials in the country, third in line in the order of presidential succession, traveling to the Manhattan office of a billionaire businessman to ask for his help in an internecine congressional fight, captures just how far the Republican Party's fulcrum of power had shifted toward the outside donors by 2011. In the final days of July, with default looming, Obama thought he was close to reaching a deal with Boehner. It was an abomination in the eyes of many Democrats because, among other features, it included cuts in projected Medicare and Medicaid spending. Obama had bought into the idea that cutting the deficit was of paramount importance and believed that the deal was necessary to stabilize the economy. He started preparing Democrats on the Hill for the painful news. Yet when the president called Boehner to formalize the agreement the night of July 21st, to Obama's growing fury, with the clock ticking dangerously toward default, the speaker didn't call him back. The president made multiple calls. He left messages. Almost an entire day passed. Finally, when Boehner called, it was to break off the talks, walk away, and then denounce Obama publicly. With no basis in fact, according to Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein's study of congressional dysfunction, "It's Even Worse Than It Looks," Boehner claimed that the president had reneged on the terms of their agreement. "I gave it my all," Boehner proclaimed. "Unfortunately, the president would not take yes for an answer." Cantor later told the real story to Ryan Lizza of The New Yorker. Blowing up the grand bargain had been his idea. He said it was a fair assessment to say that in the critical final moments, he had talked Boehner out of accepting the deal for purely political reasons. Cantor had argued, why give Obama a win? Why aid his re-election campaign by helping him look competent? It would be more advantageous for the Republicans to sabotage the talks, regardless of the mess it left the country in, and wait to see if the next year's presidential election brought them a Republican president who would give them a better deal. The eventual result was what Lizza described as a Byzantine arrangement in which, in order to forestall default, both parties agreed to automatic spending cuts imposed indiscriminately across the whole budget. No one believed the mindless cuts, which were called a sequester, would even get enacted. But in fact, when no other resolution could be reached, they were. The mechanism placed Obama in a fiscal straitjacket indefinitely. The chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, Emanuel Cleaver, denounced the deal as a sugar-coated Satan sandwich, which the House Minority Leader, Pelosi, amended to a Satan sandwich with Satan fries on the side. The political damage stretched far and wide. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimated that the sequester would cost the economy 750,000 jobs a year and hurt millions of Americans who were reliant on public services. Standard & Poor's downgraded America's credit rating for the first time in the country's history. The stock market plummeted, falling 635 points on the spot. The public, meanwhile, was so disgusted with Congress that polls registered the lowest approval rating in the history of such measurements. Obama's popularity also took a hit, dropping below the all-important 50% threshold for the first time. He was derided and belittled by both the left and the right. Internal polls called him weak. A political minority, responding to the interests of its extreme sponsors, had succeeded in rendering the most powerful democracy in the world dysfunctional. 30 years after the Libertarian Party platform called for the abolition of Medicare and Medicaid, the repeal of the increasingly oppressive Social Security system, and the eventual repeal of all taxation, its billionaire backers had the upper hand. At this point, Neera Tanden believes, the president finally understood what he was up against. I think he came in truly trying to be post-partisan, she said. I think it took the debt ceiling fight to make him see that they hated him more than they wanted to succeed. It was an irrational deal, driven by their funders. 2.5 years into his presidency, she said, he finally realized they would rather kill him than save themselves.